Psych Podcast, a podcast where we talk about everything intro psych. And as always, I'm joined by my friend, my colleague, my collaborator, Paul Bloom. Welcome, Paul.
Very good to talk to you again, David.
Again, I say welcome every time, but we have been talking already for an hour.
That's right. A bit of the behind the scenes behind this.
That's right. So, Paul, today we're talking about something that I think the whole world might think, well, of course, intro psych people are going to talk about this. But psychologists would say, that's weird that they're talking about this. And that topic is Sigmund Freud, his work, his theories, his status as a scientist, his reputation. You and I are a little odd in this regard, right? We both enjoy talking about Freud.
We are. This is maybe there's a lot of topics that we're going to go over where psychologists have different ideas than people who aren't in the field. But this is one where there's a shocking disconnect in the popular sense of how important Freud is versus within our field, how he's treated. And we are a little bit unusual in that you and I take him very seriously. I devote a class on him in my intro psych class and a chapter on him in my book. I think Freud is important. I think he's worth learning about. I think he's worth talking about, worth debating. But a lot of people in psychology find him an embarrassment. I have received emails from people I respect saying, "Oh, yeah, I enjoyed your book, maybe, but I don't know why you have a chapter on Freud." The way I put it in the book is many psychologists feel about him like a pharmaceutical company feels like it's got to start by selling meth. You know, maybe that's true, but let's not dwell on it. So, how much emphasis do you put on him in your course?
I also have an entire lecture devoted to Freud, and you know, it is at the expense of some other stuff that maybe I ought to talk about, but I think it's personally very important for my students to learn who he was and to learn about his theories for a few reasons. But one is just that when I make a list of things that I want my students to know by the end of this class, I want them to have a good sense of Freud's theories, the influence he's had on culture. And then I want to arm them with some good criticisms of Freud's work and use Freud's work maybe as an illustration about what is science, what isn't science, and how we ought to do science as psychologists.
That's right. So for the sake of argument, let's frame it at everything he said was wrong. Absolutely nothing of value in his work. Still, I think he's worth a lecture. I still think he's worth the time because, like you say, if his views are bad and pernicious and foolish, a lot of people have absorbed them. And so it's worth talking about it just to show them where he goes astray. He is definitely part of the popular culture. I have kind of a collection I use for my classroom lecture where I show a clip of an episode where he's talking to Sherlock Holmes or solving crimes of Sherlock Holmes or dealing with data from Star Trek or tracking down Jack the Ripper. He's in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. He's sort of a go-to historical reference. And also he's part of our pop culture, our ideas of the mind. This is maybe more substantive that have been shaped, whether we know it or not, by Freud. If you ever say to somebody, look, I'm not your mother, or, you know, he has an anal personality. You're referencing Freud, whether you know it or not. If you talk about repression or a hysteria, this is Freud.
Symbolic dream analysis.
That's right. A lot of the ideas here precede Freud. There were, you know, cultures and religions do dream analysis long before Freud came on the scene. But Freud brought this into the fore. And I'll qualify this. We could start off right away talking about the negatives. But I do want to make it clear. I think that it's too simple to say he got everything wrong. I think he got some very important stuff right.
Well, yeah. And I take it in my class as an opportunity to say, you know, not every insight into the human mind has to come from rigorous laboratory experiments. I think there are ways in which you can have insight. You and I probably both agree that the work of Dostoevsky offers keen psychological observation that not exactly what you would find if you opened the pages of Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, but nonetheless insightful.
That's right. And there's a good general point there, which is we both believe in the value of psychology, both as sort of an inquiry into the mind, but also in some ways as having practical benefits. But at the same time, if somebody's about to get married or wanted to know what it's like to raise an adolescent or wanted to know what it's like to be in a war, or to be fighting a rival for romantic conquest, I wouldn't recommend opening up a psych textbook. I'd recommend a lot of novels before I ever got to that. And I think novelists have a keen insight to human nature, which doesn't derive from experimentation, but arrives from experience and a sympathetic eye and imagination. And at his best, Freud kind of falls with the novelists more than with the experimental scientists. He actually was won prestigious awards and was nominated for Nobel Prize in literature for his writing.
Well, that gets to something else, which is a more positive reason to teach him, not just because I begrudgingly accept that he had a huge influence on our culture, but the guy was deeply interesting. It's something that you're alluding to now. And he developed a theory with this incredible scope. And he wrote these books about everything from why we tell the kinds of jokes that we do to why monotheism exists as the dominant religion. Like, the guy was just super interesting.
He was super interesting. He was a great writer. He was full of some startling insights about things, everything, like you say, from jokes to fairy tales to dreams to the origin of civilization. Yeah. His book, Civilization and Its Discontents, I think it's a wonderful book.
It's one of my favorites, yeah.
Full of just brilliant ideas. We're kind of talking around the fact that we should dive in a little bit on what he got wrong, which was a lot. But I do want to sort of maybe just put this down right early on in this, that I think what he got right is something very important, which is the idea of a dynamic unconscious, the idea that a lot of what we do is caused by forces that we are unaware of and are not fully under our conscious control. And this idea has become, whatever else people think about Freud, this idea dominates all of psychology. It dominates political psychology, social psychology, clinical psychology. And I think it's true. Now, Freud wasn't the first one to think of the unconscious. He would openly admit he had a lot of predecessors here. But he developed it, and he expanded upon it. He turned into this grand, grand theory.
I was going to say, that's another reason I find him so interesting, is nobody has theories that are as grand as this anymore, and for good reason. I think that it's hard to get a lot of things right when you try to tackle so much. But there is an elegance to the theory that Freud laid out that's independent of the truth value, let's say. And that elegance is that with a very simple idea that there exists this dynamic unconscious, that is at the heart of all of his explanations, whether it be about dreams or jokes or psychopathology or adult personality or the development of civilization. It all fits together with Freud in a way that's quite impressive.
It's impressive in its complexity and its richness. The only thing that comes close to his grand theory is Skinner's grand theory, behaviorism, who also tried to reduce just about everything interesting to their own theoretical framework, and is in some way the exact opposite of Freud, where Skinner was bizarrely, painfully minimalist, saying, you just got these couple of learning principles. That's it. And in fact, we share them with rats and pigeons and monkeys, and that explains everything. And while Freud had this theory with multiple parts of the conscious and unconscious mind, all sorts of mechanisms, all sorts of developmental stages and processes, and it's just blazingly baroque and complicated. And maybe there's sort of two sorts of scientists. One who looks at Freud says, wow, you know, maybe that's wrong, but that's the kind of theory I think is going to be ultimately the right sort of theory about the mind. And others who look at Skinner and say, this sharp, elegant, and minimalist theory, that's how to go.
So, Paul, you mentioned one of Freud's perhaps lasting contributions in the field of psychology is this idea of the unconscious. To play devil's advocate, I've talked to many psychologists who say, well, slow down, let's not give them too much credit. The idea of the unconscious, as we think of it in cognitive psychology, for instance, is not that dynamic kind of motivational entity, that the id of Freud. Rather, it's just, you know, processes that don't make their way into awareness, which sort of has to be the case the way that the brain processes information. So when we talk about implicit memory, for instance, I don't need to appeal to anything like what Freud said.
I think that's a fair response. So Freud's notion of the unconscious involved unconscious conflicts, and your mind sort of at war with itself, and what you perceive is the sort of end result of that battle. But a lot's been going on. Well, a lot of modern day psychology, I think, will have more minimal approaches to the unconscious. Just say basically some low level associations or some low level processes. I think, though, when you look at social psychology and political psychology, you see more of a Freudian framework than these people would admit to. So, for instance, there's some social psychologists who say that that the political parties we vote for, the political views we have, are often maintained by issues of insecurity. We worry about our own status. We want to justify the system, the status quo. These are really complicated ideas. But these psychologists would say, look, you're not going to find out whether they're true just by asking people, because the people are unaware of them. So if it's true that the reason why I voted for who I voted is because, given who I am, I only want to justify my own situation, and I want to support the party in power, and I want to support the way things have always been done. I'm a naturally conservative, say. If that's true, that does look kind of Freudian.
There's some work on metaphor, like by George Lakoff, that argues that there are guiding metaphors of the maternal or a paternal influence. And I can't help sometimes but think that this has some Freudian affinity.
That's right. If you have a political psychologist who essentially argue that people voted for Trump, say, because he's a father figure, that sounds very, very Freudian.
Yeah.
Or people who are motivated by concerns about security or dominance. It's almost certainly less complicated than Freud would have it. Freud had these immensely complicated, rich stories. But nonetheless, there's a Freudian flavor to it.
And I think Freud would take some delight in knowing that psychologists proposed theories that were so similar to Freud's, while at the same time boo-hooing Freud and Freudianism.
His constant refrain to his critics, one of the many reasons why people hated him, was that he viewed rejection of his ideas as itself a symptom of psychological problems, as a sort of pathology. So, you know, when people disagreed with him, he would basically say, well, let's try to get into the fact how what's wrong with you, and so that you fail to appreciate the truths I'm bringing out for you.
One of the best examples of that comes from his correspondence with former student of his, Carl Jung, former mentee, where he just over and over again accuses him of essentially trying to kill him as a father figure.
Yes, yes, yes. Freud would often do that in a way which we don't do this anymore, which is he would take his current life, his battles, his relationship, analyze them through the filter of his own theory, and then talk about him as such. And he was not afraid to see himself as a father figure to his students.
I think there's another way in which Freud has had a lasting influence on psychology that I don't see talked about as much. And that is, I think Freud in many ways put a focus on developmental processes where there just wasn't before. So you had, of course, theories of psychology, but it was rare to see psychological thinkers focus so much on that period of life between ages 0 through 6. As important at all. And I think that the dominant view of childhood was a sort of waiting room for adulthood. It was you're just shorter and dumber. But you'll get there.
No, that's right. We never sort of think Freud, developmental psychologist. But his theory very much saw what goes on with us as adults as the consequence of what happened to us as children. As the consequence of a developmental process that sometimes goes awry, and so more than just about anybody, until you got to somebody like Jean Piaget, he cared a lot about what happened with kids.
Yeah, and he I think, rightfully viewed the mind of the child as a much more active thing. For Freud to look at them and say, there is an incredible amount of psychic development that is occurring, as, you know, a two-year-old is sitting there sucking on their thumb or pooping their pants, is I think, an insight that he deserves credit for.
Yeah, and for recognizing that a lot goes on in kids, and particularly somewhat older kids, including a lot of turmoil and conflict and struggle, navigating their own desires, navigating the social context that they fell into, navigating a relationship with their mother and their father. I mean, some of it, again, I've always, you know, I'm not the first to point, it's a bit over the top. My favorite example of this is, you know, his obsession with the sexuality of children, where it's not entirely off the mark. There's some sense of sexuality in which it does apply to kids, and children are, to some extent, sexual beings, or at least beings who were seeking out some sort of physical pleasure and connection. But he took it to all these, he talked about the Oedipal or Oedipus complex, where a child, a boy, would fall in love with his mother, and then come to fear that his father would take vengeance and would do so by castrating him. And this castration, it's not just some weird thought some kid might have. Every boy, you and I, had at one point worried about being castrated by our fathers. He said every girl experiences penis envy, you know, seeing the penises of brothers or father, and then saying, oh, mine must be gone. I wish I had one. And then that develops her, connects to her feelings about her mother. This is all, you know, really fun to read about and listen and read and learn about what Freud had to say about it. It's not clear any of this is that true.
Right. And it's not clear how we would find out if it were or not, because he very much explicitly believed that it's not as if a child could ever report, say, penis envy or the Oedipal conflict as it's occurring. And by the time they're adults, it is completely repressed. I'm of two minds sometimes. I mean, I think it's incredibly weird how Freud developed these theories of childhood sexuality. But I do think that one of the, probably the final thing I'll say that he deserves a lot of credit for, is expanding our notion of what sexuality is and what it means. And I think here it's important to make note of the context in which Freud proposed his theories, which was very, very repressed society of the Victorian era, where all of this stuff was so taboo that I think people in fact did have issues repressing sexuality that maybe they have less of now. So for Freud to propose his theories at that time, I think makes a little more sense, because he was developing some of these theories from treating patients who often had symptoms that, you know, I don't know if we would ever see them today. They seem very much like the kinds of therapeutic sessions of a repressed Victorian era.
Yeah. I mean, that's a nice way to put it. You read Freud now, and there's a tendency to say, look, sex is important. It's not that important. It doesn't permeate everything the way Freud thought. But in a repressed era, it's one of the sort of paradoxes of mental life that the more pressure is not to think something or do something or talk about something, the more important it is. And in this highly repressed era, maybe sex was a lot more important. Maybe Freud was onto something. Freud lived in an age where people, usually women, had hysterical symptoms.
By hysterical, we would now, I guess, call conversion disorder.
That's right.
Clearly psychological causes to some very bodily symptoms that made no sense medically.
That's right. So they'd have parts of their body become paralyzed. They would have bizarre gaps of memory. They would have sometimes have forms we call hysterical blindness or hysterical deafness, where nothing physical is wrong with their body, but they can't see or hear. And then, of course, topped up with the usual obsessive thoughts and uncontrollable moods of sorrow or elation. And ultimately, when you end up talking to Freud, you do his psychoanalytic stuff with you. We should talk about that a bit.
Yeah.
But he would come up with a theory as to why, where these came from. And ultimately, in most cases, it came down to something sexual. And he actually had, there was an interesting, you could call it a development in this theory where early on in his career, he thought the sexual stuff was actually caused by real sexual abuse early on in life. That was very important. Later on, and there's been a lot of controversy as to why he made the change, he shifted more to the idea that these sexual, the memories of sexual abuse were actually, in some way, he'd call them fantasies, or they didn't really happen. They were created by his patients.
That's right. And he's received a lot of criticism for this, with some saying that he was part of the problem at that point and that he was maybe under some pressure to hide the fact that this abuse was going on. And again, I'm a little bit of two minds, because on the one hand, I think Freud bringing female sexuality to light in a way that people were just afraid to talk about was important. But, you know, his theories were in many ways deeply sexist, and I think it's fair to call him out.
They were. They were also, you know, he had odd views about homosexuality, thinking about it as a sort of mental, psychological problem. I guess I say odd views, views that people don't have today, but were probably common enough in this time. And he viewed it as the product of kind of messed up developmental processes. At the same time, though, apparently, whatever Freud's personal flaws were, he was actually in correspondence with people, progressive by our lights, about gay men or gay women. I think there's a more general thing about sexuality. I quote this essayist in my book, and I can't say it as well as he does. But the main idea put forth is that by focusing people on a range of sexuality, including female sexuality, and providing such as an often bizarre, and you could say maybe shockingly honest, perspective on our sex drive, Freud made sex permissive for those people who don't fall into the normal categories that we have, the sort of standard Victorian categories of, you know, straight man, straight woman. And you know, the way I put it in my book is, if everyone's a pervert, nobody's a pervert. And for Freud, everyone's a pervert.
This episode of the Psych Podcast is once again sponsored by GiveWell.org. Paul and I are very proud to have GiveWell as our recurring sponsor. GiveWell is the gold standard for giving, as the Boston Globe referred to it. GiveWell shares top charities that they've found for saving and improving lives. When you go to their website, you simply choose the top charity that you prefer, or you can have GiveWell direct your donation where it will help the most. GiveWell takes no fees in return and sends your donation to the organizations that you choose. Your donations make meaningful differences for some of the poorest people in the world. GiveWell has dedicated a team of researchers to finding these best charities. They spend over 40,000 hours each year conducting this research. They conduct in-depth evaluations to find out which of these charities are the most effective. And they make all of this research available for absolutely free. So all you have to do is go to their website and you have access to all of this research. You don't have to sign up. You don't have to give them any information about yourself. It's just there because they want people to use it. If you're considering donating to a charity, and I hope that you are, consider joining the over 100,000 donors that have already used GiveWell to donate more than $1 billion. If you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $500 before the end of the year, or as long as matching funds last. And if you heard about them from us, just go to givewell.org and pick podcast at checkout and enter our name, Psych at checkout. Once again, that's givewell.org at checkout, select podcast and enter Psych. Our thanks to GiveWell for sponsoring this episode of Psych.
So we're talking at a sort of abstract level. Do you feel brave enough to dive in and talk about his stage theory?
Let's jump in.
Right. So beginning, the child starts off as an id, a sort of single animal, set of animal desires. Yes, this phrase, a polymorphous perversity, which I'm not sure I know exactly what it means, but it's supposed to describe what's going on at this very early point.
It's a great name for a band.
That's right. And so the first stage, and the little kid as it is the oral stage, where the pleasure, the primary source of pleasure, is the mouth, and plainly, you know, breastfeeding is an example of it, and for Freud, and this is something he says about all the stages, if you don't do it properly, if you don't go through this stage properly, you're condemned to focus on it for the rest of your life. So a child who is, say, weaned too early may become fixated at oral stage and then becomes an oral personality. And for Freud, that can mean literally, like you eat too much or you smoke or you always chew gum or whatever. You just focus on pleasure through the mouth. But it could also mean it in a sense that's metaphorically, where you may want to, you know, eat the world. You may be greedy, acquisitive. Next stage is the anal stage, toilet training. And there the pleasure is through control, expulsion, control of the feces. And then if you're stuck in that phase due to poor toilet training, for instance, you can become an anal personality, which is, you know, just as a child may wish to cling to his or her own body waste, an adult might cling to money or cling to possessions.
A hoarder might be an anal retentive personality type. Just the use of the phrase anal personality or anal retentiveness is one that I don't think a lot of students realize where it comes from, because it's such a common way of talking. The anal stage could also lead to a fixation of a different sort that would lead to what Freud referred to as an anal expulsive personality. And that one isn't talked about as much, but if the anal retentive personality is the neurotic person who wants to keep things, the anal expulsive kind is the one who throws away everything. So again, from the literal to the metaphorical. When we say anal, we usually mean anal retentive, but I think anal expulsive should make its way into our vocabulary.
Well, there we go. I think here a little bit, we're starting to see something which we're going to focus on a little bit later on, which is the potential for a problem with Freud's theory, where it seems like he's saying a lot could come out from these problems. And I guess it's fully possible that something and its opposite could both be the consequence of difficulty at a certain stage. It's not crazy. But we do see a certain flexibility here in his predictions. And then from there, the major moment, and Freud, as he did his theorizing, was primarily concerned with men. With boys and boys turning into men. Girls were often an afterthought. So for males, there's the Oedipal complex. Child falls in love with his mother.
And this is in the phallic stage.
It is in the phallic stage. The phallic stage is focused on the penis as a source of pleasure. And then the resolution of this stage, I think, coincides with the development of superego.
We should say that at the beginning, while the child is all id and id is dominated by this seeking out of pleasure, early on, the child starts to realize that the world poses some serious constraints on their pleasure seeking. And rather than be dominated by the pleasure principle, now comes to be dominated by the reality principle, which coincides with the development of the ego, your conscious self.
And then you get to the third part, which I think develops out of the Oedipal complex, which is the superego. And the superego is often talked about as a sort of a conscience. And the sort of standard way to illustrate the Freudian trilogy is Trinity is the best word, is you imagine a person with an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other. The person is the ego, the self. The devil is the id. The angel's the superego. But Freud was clear it's not entirely right. The superego is the sort of nagging voice telling you what you should do. But sometimes it could be the sort that upon moral reflection, you say, yeah, that's the voice of morality, that's conscience telling me not to hurt people, telling me to be a good person. But it can also be stupid. It will also internalize rules from society that upon reflection, you might think are actually foolish, but you still got it in your head.
The process by which the superego emerges, at least in boys, is from the resolution of the Oedipal conflict when the child is in love with his mother, hates his father, has castration anxiety, though thinks that the father might get really mad and cut his penis off, which all sounds quite ludicrous, but this was the theory. And at some point here, the young boy has a sort of, if I can't beat him, the father is way too powerful. If I can't beat him, I should join him. And so the child internalizes the father's representation. The father represents rules and regulations and all of those higher, both moral, but societal constraints on their action. Importantly, the superego developing through the Oedipal conflict meant that for Freud, boys had a stronger moral sense than girls, who never had that kind of way to develop their superego.
And Freud wasn't shy about this implication. He didn't try to. He said, you know, this is why women don't have as much of a moral sense as men, because they didn't go through this development of superego. There were attempts by Freud and by his followers, like Carl Jung, to do an analogous process for girls, sometimes called Electra complex, which the variants of this are so complicated and subtle and kind of bizarre that I don't go into the book and I can't recount it properly, but it was an attempt to say, wow, well, you know, we've left out half the human race in this theory of psychosexual development. Let's kind of work back and try to explain the girls.
Yeah, I like to think of Freud and his followers as quick, get me a encyclopedia of Greek mythology. Look up the girls. See if there's anything we can use here.
Carl Jung, I'm a quote from the own book here, which I'm looking at, which he says, Carl Jung's story is complex, involving penis envy, a desire to create a son who would have the missing penis, a shift to the vagina as expression of mature sexuality, and much else.
I must say that Carl Jung's theories, while interesting, lacked the simplicity and elegance of Freud.
I've had people ask me, people say, well, you spend a chapter on Freud. What do you spend on Jung? And the answer is nothing. I mention him only as a student of Freud. And maybe that's a weakness. I've been told that there are some really real insights in this most famous student of Freud and what he had. He's also talked about, I think people often know him for his talk about archetypes.
Yeah.
And there's some real insights there, but it never had quite the staying power of Freud's theory. So you go through all this developmental stuff, and if you are unscathed by it, if you've gone through it normally and happily, you're a fully functioning normal adult. If not, you might have various problems that you have to work through. But even for normally healthy adults, there's all sorts of inner turmoil. And so Freud talked about different mechanisms designed to sort of mediate the relationship between the id and the rest of mental life, called defense mechanisms.
So for Freud, all motivation comes from the id. One of the ways in which that energy from the id gets turned into the kind of motivation that we think of as normal motivations of adults is by being filtered through these defense mechanisms of the ego.
Right. So Freud might say our podcast is the product of sublimation, where we have these inappropriate desires from the id, and we transform them into socially acceptable activities, like, if it counts as one, doing a podcast.
That's right. Or a surgeon might be just somebody who has very murderous impulses, but has found a way to cut into human beings for the sake of the greater good.
And some of these things are common sense. So rationalization for Freud was a defense mechanism. A father enjoys hitting his kids, and that's quite a forbidden bit of knowledge. So it gets transformed into fathers thinking, well, I hit my children for their own good, as a way to discipline them. I hit them because I love them, because I don't want to do this. There are others like projection, where you take your own shameful thoughts and you attribute them to other people, or reaction formation, which is kind of a weird one. But the idea is that you replace whatever you feel towards somebody, if it's forbidden, with the opposite. And this is, in one case, the stuff of romantic comedies, where, you know, people, they hate each other and yelling at each other, but ultimately by the end they fall into each other's arms, because this anger they had to each other really masked the deep affection that really existed.
And reaction formation and projection are defense mechanisms that, you know, people often point out quite in popular culture, the heterosexual man who is very homophobic, many people think, well, it's because he himself has homosexual desires that he is masking.
Yeah, that'd be a perfect example. There were some early studies, I think, which suggested that this is true, that actually straight men who really express deep animosity towards gay men were more aroused by sexual images of naked men. I'm not sure that field has really stood up.
I don't know if it's been replicated at all, but it was a cool study where they actually showed sexual imagery and measured arousal objectively and found that men scoring higher in homophobia had more arousal to the gay images.
So this is Freud's theory in very broad outline, and it's a theory of mental illness was expressed in these terms, in terms of failures of defense mechanisms to do their work, of developmental anomalies. And to fix all this, Freud basically invented the mechanisms of psychoanalysis.
Talking therapy in general is an idea that comes from Freud. So all of the varieties of therapy that we have now, even the most anti-Freudian of the evidence-based cognitive behavioral therapies, owe a debt to the idea that Freud had, which was we can talk our way through some of the problems that you're experiencing.
Yeah, one of his patients called it a talking cure.
And for Freud, though, specifically, and for thousands and upon thousands of modern day psychoanalysts who still employ this kind of therapy, the goal was to take the surface problems that you're experiencing, whether these be psychological distress or physical distress, and relieve them by tapping into the root cause. And the root cause, of course, for Freud was something in the unconscious. So he employed a lot of techniques to try to make the unconscious conscious.
Yeah. And at different times in his career, he used hypnosis. He used free association. You see this in movies sometimes where, somebody says cat and you say dog, and they say mother and you say sex. And oh my God, there's immediate responses to things.
Dream analysis,
definitely dream analysis. So Freud distinguished the dream as experienced, which is filtered by different defense mechanisms, so you don't you're not exposed too much to the harsh realities of your id, and the real dream, which through analysis you can get. So Freud would often, patients would come to him with dreams, and Freud would interpret them, and would often interpret them in very sexual terms.
Your ego defenses are weaker during dreams. So you get more of a leakage of your true id, but it's still filtered somewhat. So figuring out what these dream symbols meant, a way of figuring out what your unconscious desires really were.
Yeah. And when Freud was either talking about everyday life or working with patients, he would point out that things like speech errors and jokes and omissions were like you can't find a word or something. At every point, he was saying, there we see the filtering mechanism at work. There in that joke, we see what you really want. In that error, what you were really thinking. So Freud would get the patients on the couch and ask, and they would literally be lying on a couch in classic Freudian analysis. They would be turned away so they would not be able to see the person giving the therapy, because they don't want to get you don't want to get caught up, and you want to treat this as a situation where as a patient, you're just going to spill out your thoughts. The therapist will ask leading questions and you talk about your dreams. You might free associate a bit. You might mull over and talk about your life. Typically, the therapist is fairly non-directive. The therapist isn't going to say, hey, you should do this, or here's some practice, or what I think, the way I make sense of what's going to happen is this, but rather elicit from the patient more and more ideas, and gradually with the goal of achieving what psychoanalysts call, and we call too, insight, where you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, I see what's going on. And the idea was, to some extent, insight itself was curative. If you achieve insight, your problems will go away.
And this process for Freud took a minimum of 5 years, multiple sessions a week.
5 days a week, an hour per session, 50 minutes actually, where, yes.
And that's still the way that many psychoanalysts practice. They believe that you need a minimum of 5 years of therapy.
So you could see that this is not very, it doesn't mesh well with the world we live in now.
That's right.
And for one thing, there are people who are very skeptical as to whether psychoanalysis really does cure the problems, or at least cures them better than much quicker means. And when we talk about clinical psychology, we're really going to dive into that. But also insurance companies and, or failing that, people's budgets typically can't survive, you know, such extensive therapy for so long, the time, the commitment. So in order to do it in the real world, typically you're somebody who's fairly wealthy.
Yes. I was going to say it's therapy for the rich.
Yes. It's associated with certain parts of the world, New York City, New Haven, Connecticut, where Yale is, where you and I both lived a while ago, is a haven for psychoanalysts.
Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Yes, yes. In other parts of the world, Freud is much more prominent than it is here. And I think, you know, I spoke to a friend of mine who's from Colombia, and she said that in that country, most of psychology training, at least from her own experience, is a lot more Freudian. Well, you know, if you take psychology at Cornell, where you are, University of Toronto, where I am, you find Freud will never be mentioned.
I'm already envisioning our colleagues asking us why we're spending so much time talking about Freud.
A whole episode.
Let's talk a little bit about the failures of his theory. And there's one big point that we've already alluded to that I like to make when I teach Freud. Which is that it's just not good for a theory to be this unfalsifiable. You want to say a little bit about what we mean by unfalsifiable?
Yeah. It's an idea developed by the philosopher Karl Popper, who set himself up the project. Where do you distinguish science from something that's not science? What makes something a science? And Popper's idea is that a science, a real science, makes falsifiable claims. That is, claims that could be proven false. Not claims that could be proven true. Everything does that. But claims that could be proven false. So if you could see in that way, a lot of psychology is falsifiable. So if I say that the part of the brain known as the hippocampus is used to make sense of spatial knowledge, where things are. If you say that men and women differ everywhere in certain aspects of their sexual desires, if I say four-year-olds everywhere have a problem reasoning about certain abstract things, so one of the interesting things about all those claims is you could prove them wrong. You could find that, oh my gosh, it's a different part of the brain that has spatial knowledge. Oh my gosh, in this country, there's a difference. That different men and women doesn't exist, that when you test four-year-olds properly, you do find this knowledge. And not things that aren't science can't be tested this way. Most horoscopes are so vague that you can't prove them wrong. Anything that's going to happen is going to fit with it, with that. That's how fortune tellers often work. They tell you things that no matter how you look at it, can't be wrong. But if something can't be wrong, it can't be right. I like to quote the physicist Wolfgang Pauli, who heard about another physicist theory. And in a dismissive way, he says, it's not right. It's not even wrong.
I love that.
And as scientists, we try to be, if not right, at least we try to be wrong. But if it turns out our claims are so vague that they can't be precluded by the data, it's not science. Now, we should now qualify this by saying most philosophers of science and most working scientists would say this is too stringent a criteria. You can't, a major theory like, say, evolutionary theory or plate tectonics or whatever, often is so complicated that a single claim can't really be proven wrong. You could explain any failure to support it through changing sort of other assumptions. But I think the spirit of it is right, where good science and good psychology makes claims about the world. You say, wow, that doesn't have to be true. Let's see if it is.
Freud didn't have that well, I was wrong bit. He could always find some way that the information could be accommodated by his theory. Opposite things could both be taken as support for theory. And that's just a bad theory.
Yeah. And so there's countless examples of this. Many of the examples comes from his own therapeutic practice. So there's an example I tell in the book of a woman who describes a dream to Freud. And she's wearing, I'll quote from her description, "I was wearing a straw hat of peculiar shape, the middle piece of which is bent upwards, while the side pieces hang downwards. And as such, and I am cheerful, I am in a confident mood. And as I pass a number of young officers, I think to myself, you can't do anything to me. And Freud says to her, I can interpret this, he says, the hat is really a male genital organ. If, therefore, she had a husband with such splendid genitals, she would not have to fear for the officers. That is, she would have nothing to wish from them. She came to him with agoraphobia, and he concludes, based on the description of her dream, that her agoraphobia, she doesn't want to leave her house, is based on worries about her own temptations to have sex with strange men. And this dream is sort of the manifestation of these concerns. And you read this, you think that's really clever. But going back to what we're talking about, what could she say that could prove him wrong?
Right. And particularly because any resistance to what Freud was saying would be taken as further evidence that he must be right. So either she could say, well, maybe that's the case. And Freud might say, yes, see, I'm very insightful. And if she said, you're absolutely ridiculous, the genitals of my husband are perfectly fine and satisfying, he could say, that's exactly what somebody who is under threat would say.
Yes. Yeah. So the theory had a built-in response to anybody, to making it very difficult to falsify. And as a result, it sort of stifles scientific progress. It makes it less of a scientific theory.
And it's particularly odd that Freud was so unabashed in the way in which he used his theory like this. He almost leaned into the unfalsifiability at times, when he was actually somebody who viewed his theories as being built on an empirical foundation that was unlike any of the theories of his contemporaries, right? He actually took his theories as deriving from his very careful observations of his patients.
Yeah, Freud was adamant about that the psychodynamic program, as they call it, or psychoanalytic program, was a science on a par with other sciences. He has this lovely passage where he says that, you know, we are third of three sciences in our discoveries. The first is the discovery that the Earth is not the center of the universe, which really humbled us. The second is the discovery of Darwin and others that we are not the product of special creation. The human body has been shaped by the same evolutionary force that shaped every other creature. But from my science, the biggest discovery has come out, that we are not master of our own fates, that is the unconscious mind that reigns. So he wouldn't be satisfied with what we said earlier. We said, well, oh, he has so many insights. He's like a novelist. Like this is great. This is great literature. He would find that, I think, deeply condescending. He'd say, no, I'm on a par with the cosmologists and the biologists in my discoveries about the mind.
Yeah. And I firmly believe that he's not. And I like to take that part of class to emphasize why I think that the burden on modern empirical psychology is to come up with better foundations for their theories and their claims. But look, it's not as if we can't be criticized in very similar ways for a whole lot of our current theories and our current findings.
I'm really into the questions about pleasure and happiness and everything. And I have met many smart psychologists who say, you know, one interesting fact about people is everything we do exists because we want to have greater pleasure, to increase pleasure and reduce pain. And then I say, well, yeah, but okay, but what about when people who die on the battlefield to save their comrades? Oh, they imagine there's pleasure in heaven. And what about people who sacrifice for their children? And they say, oh, they get pleasure from sacrifice. And you realize that this view, this hedonistic view, is actually unfalsifiable. And a lot of views in moral psychology and motivational psychology are just as bad as the worst of Freud. I will say one thing, which is a lot of people have said, look, Freud's theory in the hands of Freud and his colleagues had makes all sorts of unfalsifiable claims. But we take his theory and test it. We can make it falsifiable. So, for instance, you know, we talked about the stages. If Freud is right, whether or not the child's pattern of breastfeeding should relate to his or her later personality. If Freud is right, toilet training should have a profound effect on how somebody is later on in life. And if Freud is right, then the psychology of somebody who is raised by a woman, just a mother, or just a father, or raised by two women or two men, should be profoundly different than a child who's raised by a mother and a father. Because, for instance, the Oedipal complex and Electra complex can't take place in these unconventional arrangements. And as best we know, Freud's wrong for all of this. When you take his theory and says, these are really interesting, strong predictions, the predictions don't work out.
Right. And I don't know how psychoanalysis as a general therapy has fared, but my understanding is not well. So when you take, I mean, this is quite a difficult thing to do, but as best as people have tried to place individuals in different kinds of therapeutic conditions, you know, to do the science and randomly assign people to have either cognitive behavioral therapy or some other form of therapy or psychoanalysis, psychoanalysis doesn't fare too well. Randomly assigning people to therapies is not done very often, so it's hard to tell. But therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy for specific problems, like phobias, which I think Freud would say was pretty much right up his alley, cognitive behavioral therapies and behavioral therapies do a lot better.
It's true. And we're going to dive into that later on in a later discussion. At the same time, though, I've heard Freudians respond to this by saying, look, if you want to get rid of your, you know, fear of flying or something, this long sequence of psychoanalytic, a therapy isn't probably the best thing. But you know what we could provide for you? We could provide for you insight. We can give you, over the course of many, many sessions and years, a deep understanding of how you work, making you a better person, a better father, a better mother, better friend, better at work, better at love, and give you insight. So it's not like we're best targeted like a laser beam at specific problems, you know, doctor, I have this twitch, but rather, doctor, I want to understand myself.
And I'm not so resistant to that claim. But part of it is that I believe that in the hands of a person who is good at getting a patient to be comfortable enough to talk about some of the most uncomfortable things and talk about their unhappiness in life, doing that for 5 years, I think must be something that would work. And maybe what might predict success in that sort of scenario is just how good a therapist that person is.
We're jumping ahead, but people who study the efficacies of different therapies often talk about what they call a dodo bird verdict. This is something from Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, where there's a big competition. And the dodo bird declares something like, everybody has won and everybody must get prizes. And the finding is that all therapies tend to do reasonably well. Differences between therapies often, as you say, come down to differences between therapists. And one idea here is that all therapies often do well because they all share certain things, which a psychoanalytic therapist would also have, which is, you know, a compassionate, intelligent person wanting to make you better, who cares about you, who's willing to take the time and energy to work with you to solve your problems, a feeling of hope that they're doing something which they believe will work, and maybe you'll believe will work too. And that could be extremely powerful. Even taking away all of this stuff about dream content and repressed sexual desire and everything, just having a smart person to talk to who cares about you could mean the world.
I think that must be right. And we will get to it when we talk about clinical psychology, but I have not read your book that far in.
Well, so why are you reluctant to read my book?
Well, it's because I view you as a father figure, and in some way I deeply resent your influence over me.
Reading the book would be like murdering me or murdering yourself, perhaps.
That's right. It's really that I want to savor it, so I'm stretching it out as far as I can.
Well, that's really good.
So have we done justice to Freud?
I think we've done perfect justice to Freud, and that we talked a lot, we trash-talked him a lot and talked about his weaknesses. We haven't even got into his flaws as a person, which were manifest. But we've also talked about his strengths And why is it a value? Why is it important? I think that's kind of, we both agree that this is the right perspective on Freud.
Yeah, and I think modern academic psychology just doesn't do that enough. So kudos to us. We are heroes.
That's why this podcast is indispensable.
Thank you.